How can we make the world better? By making ourselves better. The Dr. Joe Show explores how you can make positive personal change by using his groundbreaking and highly effective I Am approach to understand who we are and why we do what we do. Your small changes can have big effects.
Join us now for the Dr. Joe Show with Jim Quine and your host, Dr. Joe Schrand.
Good evening, everybody. This is Jim Quine here at the fabulous WATD Studios, and we are here this evening for the Dr. Joe Show.
It's so nice to be here. Thank you, WATD, and all of our sponsors.
Exactly. And, you know, I have to say, Dr. Joe,
yes,
that tonight I would like to talk about the opioid epidemic and specifically fentanyl.
I think that's great. You know, I mean, I hate that we have to talk about it, but it's so important that we do. It's got to be the front and center part of what we're concerned with. The fact that we call it a crisis, an epidemic, it is scary. It's scary stuff.
It really is true. And I know that that folks out there in Radio Land have probably heard so much about this. But, you know, today I was struck by a couple of things. And one of the first things was, which kind of got me moving in this direction, and I know that since you are the director of the largest teenage addiction program in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts,
you are
the perfect person to talk to about this. But the first thing that was very interesting today was that President Trump sent out a tweet, and I don't remember it exactly, but to paraphrase it, it was something along the lines of, the reason that I won New Hampshire is because New Hampshire is a drug-infested den. And I, you know, I heard that, and I thought, well, what exactly did the president mean by that? So I decided that I would look up some information on the New Hampshire election, and I came across, and pretty immediately I came across an article online that was referencing the fact that both candidates, as they campaigned in New Hampshire, were struck by how many questions they were asked about problems with opioids, the opioid crisis, quote unquote. And in the process of that, the article went on to discuss what was going on, specifically from a New Hampshire focus. It was a New Hampshire newspaper article. And the one that I was looking at that what probably caught my attention the most was the number that at that point in time in the fall of 2016, 542 people in New Hampshire had died as a result of overdoses. And that got me wondering about that, especially because it mentioned fentanyl in particular. Mm-hmm. So going on and looking at a little bit more research, I had an opportunity to read a DEA report from 2016.
DEA, Drug Enforcement Agency.
Exactly, the Drug Enforcement Agency. And it was a very interesting article. It was a dispassionate presentation of information, a lot of statistics. And one of the statistics that I was struck by was the fact that in 1993, deaths by gun violence in the United States reached their peak level. Since then, they've been coming down, and it was about between 38 and 39,000. At the same time, deaths by automobile accidents in the United States are rolling somewhere around 50,000 a year.
And have those come down?
No, they do at different points
different
in time.
Points. Right.
But in 2016, 62,000 people died from overdoses. And penetrating beyond that and looking at that and trying to figure out, well, how, you know, getting some more information about why is this happening. And it's very interesting to look at the history of how the opioid crisis really developed. And in particular, this new component, I say it's new because I think it's new to the awareness of people, but I don't think it's necessarily new. In the late 1990s, a number of new opioids were introduced by the drug industry that were purported to be great in terms of pain reduction, and they were presented as medications that would not then become addictive. And that became very popular, in particular, a number of them, which I'm sure you're going to be able to describe in much more detail than I can. But it was clearly a situation where the drug industry was making had discovered a new profit center.
Yep.
And these medications were very widely prescribed. And in the process of that, Mexican drug cartels started to figure out that they could take fentanyl, which was one of the new breed of opioid medicines, and that they could then cut it into the heroin that they were selling. And they could realize much greater profits by doing that.
So I just want to make sure people understand what cut it into means. It means that you take heroin and you add another substance, fentanyl, which is 100 times stronger, which means the heroin, in quotes, that you are buying is all of a sudden like amazing and really strong and powerful. So go on.
Well, and also extremely dangerous. Essentially, the equivalent amount of 3 grains of sugar in pure fentanyl is enough to kill you.
Right.
And that's a pretty scary reality right there. And at the same time in the early, mid-2000s that drug cartels were starting to figure this out, American illegal drug producers who sell things like heroin on the street started to copy that idea and have figured out that they can do things like take fentanyl patches and squeeze the gel out of them and add it to their heroin.
That's right.
And it makes their product more profitable. And when you look at this and you realize that the addition of fentanyl at this point in time to this is a huge potential for death, not just addiction, but on its own, the capability of killing people just because, well, let's face it, people that sell drugs don't necessarily go to college for a pharmacy degree, and they may not be real careful about how much of whatever it is that they're adding, including fentanyl.
Well, I think that it's important that we not say that people who deal drugs aren't educated. I fear that they may be very well educated and are very aware of what they're doing and are very aware of how much profit they can make. People are just sort of amazed. Why would you want to deal something that potentially could kill your clientele? But that's perhaps a separate thing. I just want to come back to this number that you spoke about, Jim, 62,000 overdoses, probably an underestimation because a lot of people don't ever want to admit that somebody in their family has overdosed.
Right.
A lot of times coroners won't even really do autopsies to find out what the person died from if they're an addict. We see a lot of this, a separate topic for another time perhaps, but the poor medical care that people get when they come into emergency rooms because they are immediately labeled as an addict and all the stuff that goes on with that, the nuances that go on with that. But I just want to put the 62,000 in perspective. The population of Marshfield is probably around 25,000. So I just want people to think about that. Duxbury is about 17,000. It's as if every single person in Marshfield, Duxbury, Pembroke, in our entire area just died. I mean, it is a staggering, staggering number of people. And these are completely avoidable deaths. That's the part. They are avoidable.
And I think that we hear, I know that there's a lot of discussion about the opioid crisis, quote unquote, that is out in the media. And you hear people talking about it all the time. And there are a lot of people I know who are struggling to try to figure out a way to deal with this. And, you know, one of the changes that has taken place, I think, which is a good change over a period of time, is that the focus on addiction as a law enforcement problem has started to shift to an understanding that addiction is really an illness. But I'm very concerned because, and I'm not alone, in the fact that we continue to hear about the increasing proportion of this problem and the forecast that we're rapidly heading towards 100,000 deaths a year as a result of opioid overdose. What can we do about it? And I think that this is the part where there's a lot of discussion and there's also some controversy. And we clearly need to do something about it.
Yeah.
So I guess that from an IM standpoint, if we're looking at society, if we're looking at our nation as an I am, you know, what can we do? How can we approach this in a way that is rational and gets to the sources of the problem and also starts to bring real solutions?
Trying to understand the influences on why we have an epidemic instead of judging it and saying it's a bad thing. Of course, nobody likes this, but we have to be able to understand what the influences are. I'd be really interested to hear what any members of our audience listening, please give us a call, 781-837-4900. That's 781-837-4900. We would love to hear from you. Maybe you know somebody who has succumbed to fentanyl or heroin or any of the opioids. Maybe you are one of those people in recovery and have a story that you want to share. But what is most encouraging for me is that we are talking about this. You know, I've been working for High Point Treatment Center since 2008, and High Point has been around for much longer than that. And I must tell you, I am so impressed with what their mission is. They have been working with folks struggling with drugs and alcohol long before it was sexy. And I'm sorry to say, but right now, while I am delighted that everybody is now realizing this is a crisis, it has been here for a long time. We could have done something maybe a little earlier, but let's do something now. People have to come out of the shadows. There is no shame for this. We must fight that stigma. That's how people are going to start getting help. And there's a lot that we can begin to do.
So I know that there are a number of people that I've spoken to who are, they believe that the sort of decriminalizing approach to this is actually problematical.
It's one of the things that we really need to discuss. Folks, 781-837-4900. Please call us right after this commercial break.
We are just 3 years away from the 400th anniversary of the founding of Plymouth Colony, and Plymouth 400 is gearing up for events and programs that will educate, engage, and excite. Be part of this once-in-a-lifetime event by ordering a 2020 commemorative license plate, and you too can drive America's story. Order your 2020 license plate today at plymouth400inc.org/license plate. Looking for another way to get involved? Plymouth 400 is looking for volunteers to donate their time and talents to help make this commemoration one that leaves lasting legacies for generations to come. You can help make this anniversary an impactful moment for our community, our country, and our world. Visit plymouth400inc.org for more information. Plymouth 400, an American story, a national legacy.
Hey, Boston and the South Shore. Did you know you have a top college right here in your backyard? BestColleges.com ranked Eastern Nazarene College in Quincy a top school. Our Division of Adult and Graduate Studies offers associate, bachelor's, and master's degree programs for working adults. Classes start this fall and are just one night a week at Fall River, Brockton, and Quincy locations. See for yourself why Eastern Nazarene College is a top school for earning your undergraduate or graduate degree. Submit your application today for fall 2017. Call 617-745-3000 or visit adultstudies.enc.edu to learn more.
Gospel and Christian music fans, you need to circle Wednesday, August 9th, 7 o'clock at the First Baptist Church of Hanson. We're having a great Nashville duo, Ernie and Jason Couch. They'll be in concert at our church that evening. Don't forget it. Circle your calendars right now. These guys are known across the United States and Canada. Jason Couch, Ernie Couch, Wednesday, August 9th, 7 o'clock, First Baptist Church, Hanson, Mass. Be there.
Good evening, folks. This is Jim Quine, and we're here at the Dr. Joe Show. And this evening, we're talking about the opioid epidemic and specifically the impact of fentanyl on the nature of that problem. So, but we have somebody who's called in, which we really appreciate, Barbara from Plymouth.
You're on the air. Hello,
Barbara.
What
would you like to say to us?
Hi, Barb. I'm calling. My name's Barbara. I'm 27. And I have battled addiction for, close to 15 years now. And I just wanted to touch on the fact that fentanyl is so, so dangerous compared to the original drug, heroin, that I got into. I myself have suffered multiple overdoses, and with fentanyl coming up in the drug test on my most recent, about a year ago, I consumed the drug and didn't even overdose until almost 2 hours later. Hmm. I thought I was completely fine, went about my day, and in the middle of doing a regular everyday activity, I actually overdosed. And I wanted to touch on the fact that this drug has legs and can last for hours and hours, and that it is so much stronger than most people really understand and really look into, that the Narcan that used to be in, you know, one or two doses bring someone back, it's now taking 5, 7, and sometimes in the worst case scenario, it's not bringing anyone back.
Right.
And I know multiple people that have died in their early 20s. They never even got to really live their life. Or really see the positive side of sobriety. Yes, it is work, but there are so many positive things to being in sobriety that I don't think these adolescents nor the early 20-year-olds are really appealed to right now, and they're not really advertised, you know? I myself work a 12-step program. I come from a good family. I have a great family support, and I know that's not an option for everyone. But what I would say is education, education, and more education on the drug and the upcoming drugs. I know carfentanil is, you know, just now hitting us, and there's scientists and researchers researching everything they possibly can about that as well, because that is a whole nother ball game that we are just now dealing with.
It's on the way. Barbara, did you know that you were using fentanyl? Was there a time where you were surprised that fentanyl was showing up?
I was most definitely caught off guard. I had a little over 2 years sobriety when I relapsed a year ago, and fentanyl wasn't around when I was really using prior to that. It was, you know, maybe a very small trace of it at the end of my using. But when I was told, it all made sense to me. The feeling of my relapse, it wasn't the same. Waking up from being brought back from overdosing, it was different. It was just different.
Can you talk
physically and mentally?
Yeah, to talk a bit more about that. I think, you know, if you wouldn't mind, I think that the listening audience, you know, it seems sort of inconceivable, really, that people overdose. I think for some people, we know about the death. But what was that like, if you don't mind me asking, to, as you say, to be going about your business, and then a couple of hours later, what were the first symptoms that you began to notice?
To be honest with you, I don't want to scare anyone out there or really take away from the where the story is coming from, because I know that you and I know it's a great source. It is true. I actually, when I was revived, I obviously knew I had overdosed because I had consumed drugs, and I was actually in the back of an ambulance, thank God. So that was my first, oh no, here we go again, because prior to that, I was a chronic overdoser. So I asked what happened, where was I found, how long was I out, and the EMT's response was, you overdosed in the Plymouth police station. I was being booked at the time. I have no recollection of what got me to the Plymouth police station, nor had I any recollection of being in the police station or who found me, where did I go out? How did I go out? Did I hit my head? All these questions were running through my mind so quickly that I couldn't get them out of my mouth fast enough. Mm. And it took me about I would say a good 10 hours to really mentally process the whole situation. I had gone to a former drug dealer that I, one of the only ones I had remembered, and was told it was the same substance that I used to go and do every single day, which, come to find out through testing, it was 100% fentanyl.
Wow. Well, we are very, very glad and grateful that you're alive and that you're courageous enough to call in and share this story. Barbara
Absolutely.
From Plymouth, thank you so much. Please be a listener. Keep in touch with us as we go through this.
Thank you, Barbara. That was really valuable.
Thank you.
Yep, folks, it is real. And I just want to say that, you know, we are grateful for people like Barbara who are willing to share her story.
Courageous.
And coming out of the shadows. That's what it's going to take. Because this is not a moral issue. This is a mortal issue. People get addicted. It is just the way the brain is designed and works. But it doesn't mean we have to like it. It doesn't mean we have to condone it. We're going to hold people responsible, but let's not judge. Let's try to understand this. That's what the IM is really about. If we can step back and look again at why people do what they do, maybe next time we can help someone like Barbara before it gets to that point. Maybe Barbara can help someone, which I think she's trying to do, before it gets to that point.
Absolutely, Dr. Joe. And I'm very appreciative that Barbara called in, because that kind of direct discussion from someone who has actually experienced this is so educational for everybody, certainly for me, in terms of looking at this and trying to understand it.
I think it's inspiring. And yet I know, and I hate to say, but there's a dark side to humanity. There are some people who may say, well, you know what? You knew what she was getting into. She knew she was doing drugs. Why feel compassion?
And
that's
a concern. I think that it is. And I think one of the aspects of this which has changed over a period of time is that there is more of an understanding out there that it isn't necessarily something where it's a victimless crime. You've chosen to do this, and so you own what happens. And that seems as though it was society's approach for a number of years, in spite of the fact that it was a growing problem. And the expectation that somehow the courts and the police were going to solve this by putting people into prison,
right?
Because they were perhaps committing ancillary crimes because they were trying to get money for their addiction, and not really understanding that the addiction epidemic is an illness. And there does seem to be a turnaround with that. And yet I do know that there are people out there who think, well, you know, why not actually, you know, make it a criminalized situation? You know, why are we sort of feeding into this? And one of the things that is, that I heard about recently is this program where they are trying to figure out a way for people to be able to get their illegal drugs administered to them if they are addicted, and opening up actual clinics where people can go to take their heroin.
That's right.
And I know that there are, I believe that there are a couple of communities in Canada that have done this.
Right, and in Europe.
And they perceive that as a potential, at least one potential solution to what we're dealing with. How do you see that, Dr.
It's actually because it's on many levels. There are real, I think, benefits to it. There are some worries to it. I'd be interested, you know, if there's a listening audience out there, what they think about what we now are calling shooting galleries. 781-837-4900. So here's the idea, folks. The idea is, if somebody is addicted to heroin or fentanyl or any injectable, and rather than having them shoot up at home or in a bathroom somewhere where they are vulnerable to overdosing, have them come into a place where they are given a clean needle, they shoot up, they stay there until the high is done. And that way, if, God forbid, they overdose, they can immediately be administered Narcan as many times as they need to be revived. So this is actually happening in a lot of places, and it is absolutely reducing death. Not so sure it's reducing the incidence of addiction, but I think that is another component. But it is saving lives by having people in a safe place because they are addicted. Really very, very interesting but incredibly controversial approach, as you can imagine.
I'm really curious. I know that...
I don't want to interrupt, but I just did. The reason that the clean needles are so important is because it also looks like it will cut down on the transmission of hepatitis and AIDS, because that is one of the ways...
No question about it.
...that these chronic life-threatening diseases get transmitted is by sharing needles. And I just want folks to know that it's not just needles. If you're snorting cocaine or heroin or something with somebody who already has hepatitis, you can get it from sharing the straw. It's not just needles. So just be aware of that.
On the other hand, you're looking at public funds being put to a program because you would have to provide trained clinicians. You have to have a physical space where people can go. You have to provide trained clinicians. You have to provide the needles, the materials, and that is public money that is being spent in one way. It is actually propagating the acceptance of addiction.
Which may not be a bad thing in some ways. We can talk about it, but we're not going to just provide all these things. We're now going to provide a commercial break.
Athletic kids make for active parents. Fortunately, Good Sport in Cohasset has included gift certificates in some of WATD's Summer Sizzler giveaways. Just click on the sand pail on 95.9WATD.com. And if the temperature reaches over 95 degrees at Plymouth Airport before Labor Day, you could win a bucket full of prizes. Get great gear at Good Sport by listening to 95.9WATD. It's the Summer Clearance Event right now at Quirk Chrysler Dodge Jeep Ram on Route 139 in Marshfield. Quirk Chrysler Dodge Jeep Ram is one of the largest dealerships of its kind in New England, featuring an incredible inventory, a brand new Jeep Wranglers, great customer service, and Quirk's Chrysler Certified Service Department. Quirk Chrysler Dodge Jeep Ram is accessible from all across the South Shore, just off exit 12 on Route 3.
Quirk works to save you money. Quirk works for you.
Visit QuirkChryslerDodgeJeepRam.com.
Your special event deserves BC Tent and Awning. They have everything you'll need to make it a success. Here's BC Tent and Awning owner Bob Costa.
In 1980, I started BC Tent and Awning with a single tent. Since then, we've evolved into one of the most sought-after businesses on the South Shore and beyond. Whether for your child's birthday party or for a large corporate event, BC Tent and Awning will be there with whatever you need when you need it. That's our pledge. We also specialize in custom awnings for homes and businesses. See the many services we have to offer. Visit our website, bctent.com. Find out why we've earned praise from the Mass Audubon Society, Merv Griffin Productions, and Boston University.
Call BC Tent and Awning at 800-660-TENT. That's 800-660-TENT.
Special events call for a special company. That's BC Tent and Awning.
Hi, folks. Welcome back to the Dr. Joe Show. This is Jim Quine with Dr. Joe, and we're talking tonight about the opioid epidemic, in particular, the aspects of fentanyl that have helped to make this even worse. And we are really interested in hearing any feedback that anyone out there has. Do you think that providing facilities with public money, with your tax dollars, to allow people who are addicted to heroin to have a place to go to take that medication, and you know, is that you? Do you think that that's a good approach? Is that something that we should be spending our money on? 781-837-4900. Please give us a call and tell us what you think.
That's 781-837-4900, because it is controversial. We ended last session That's a psychiatrist in me. I can't help it. 15-minute med visits. Yeah, that's what we do now. You know what I mean? But so
that's all right. I consider this my therapy session every week, Dr. Joe.
And I do too, Jim. So this is important. will having places where people can go and use safely, will it normalize in some ways addiction? Will it say, you know what, this is an unfortunate part of the fabric of our society. We don't necessarily like it. We don't necessarily condone it. We're going to hold people responsible, but I want these people at least to have a chance of recovery. You know, we were talking about the police and the criminal system. Up in Gloucester, Gloucester started this great program where the police are actively helping those folks who are addicted. Instead of spurning them, instead of arresting them, instead of putting them in jail, they're saying, we know you're there. You're part of our community. Let us be involved. How can we help? That is so important, because then a person can say, okay, I still have value. I just want to sort of really, really briefly explain a little bit about the neuroscience. Don't fall asleep yet, Jim, because it's really interesting. All drugs and alcohol force the brain to make dopamine, a really simple, simple chemical of pleasure. But dopamine interferes with another chemical of pleasure. It's the chemical of trust called oxytocin, not OxyContin. Oxytocin. So think about this. Here's a person using, they're getting this massive, massive burst of dopamine, which is what reinforces their use the next time, but the price they're paying is trust. That's something that is educational. That's something that I think we've been spending a lot of time at my program Castle, at Drug Story Theater, at many of the different programs that I've been creating, trying to remind someone of their value. Bringing people into the community so they know they are part of this group and we are still committed to helping them. I think that works.
Which is a, you know, all of those things I think are, from my perspective, I think are really great. And, you know, that is certainly one component of trying to deal with this. I think that the educational component, especially with the programs like Drug Story Theater, you know, which you really pioneered, we're really trying to educate our youth about the dangers of addiction and how they can find themselves addicted without even wanting to be,
and without even trying to scare them. We're just getting new data coming out from Drug Story Theater that shows that so many kids realize how marijuana can affect their relationships and their school performance. That is really an important thing. It's not about scaring you, but saying, look, this is the reality. This is the way the brain works. This is the choice that you make. Folks, 781-837-4900, call, chime in. I didn't mean to cut you off, Jim.
Well, I think that the question of public funds going into this and the acceptance of it, you know, all of those things I think are valuable because they are really an IM approach. But there's a downside. And the downside is, what are we doing to stem the core problem? If someone goes to one of these treatment centers and they can they have an opportunity to take their illegal drugs there and they walk out and they were okay and everything was great and they come back and then the next week they go and they buy more illegal drugs and they go to the treatment center. At what point is that cycle going to be broken? And is it just a question of acceptance and treatment and giving these people a safe haven, a safe opportunity? Or are there some core aspects of their addiction as well as the continued criminal perpetration of selling illegal drugs that we also as a society really truly need to put weight behind at this point? I mean, recently, we all know that marijuana was legalized, and people agree or disagree with that, and that's perfectly fine, because we're the United States of America still, anyway. And the thing that is probably most concerning to me is that the legislature spent, in conjunction with input from the governor, they spent weeks and months working through the marijuana law and how to adjust it, and they came up with a 20% tax. And the discussion around the 20% tax is that's what the organization that's going to manage marijuana needs to be able to manage the sales, the legal sales of marijuana. Why wasn't a portion of that money automatically targeted to addiction programs and to identifying and stopping the sources? Why wasn't there a percentage of that that was automatically given to provide the kind of supports, to support the kind of treatment programs that you operate and many other excellent clinicians are operating right now, and to also support police funding to be able to track down and stop the flow of illegal drugs?
And it's not just about the treatment, it's about the prevention. Where's
Absolutely.
The money for prevention? Where's the money for me and others to go into schools, which is where we need to be, and educate folks and kids about the potential of addiction? You know, I know folks who've heard me say this before may get really tired of it, but here are the real numbers. If you start using drugs or alcohol after the age of 21, 1 out of 25 people are at risk for lifelong addiction. You start using before the age of 18, that number goes from 1 in 25 to 1 in 4. Jim, that's 1 in 4 kids who are at risk if they start using. 1 in 4. Where's the prevention for those kids? We need to get into the schools. The treatment, we are getting sort of better at treatment. We have more treatment options. We can talk about medical-assisted treatment, medication-assisted treatment. We can talk about the STEP programs, the fellowships. But where's the prevention?
Great. And we've got a caller, Dr. Joe, Kathy in Hanson. Kathy, what would you like to talk to Dr. Joe about?
Hi. Well, first of all, I'd like to thank Barbara, who called in. I don't know who she is, but I'm glad she's still with us.
Pretty amazing, right, Kathy? Thanks for calling
and,
yourself.
She's very courageous to share her story.
Yep.
As you were talking about the clinics, what I was wondering, and you've addressed it a little bit, is are you just giving people their drugs, or are they also doing some type of rehab part of that?
Right.
And so they're not just continuing to be addicted?
So that's a great, great question. And, you know, we don't really have these programs yet in the United States, but in the other places there is a requirement that if you want to have the safe haven of using, you also need to have some treatment and therapy that go along with it. Because that really is where the connection is as well. So a person will use, but they are also getting the supports they need. They may have family supports. They may have counseling at home. They have all these other things that they can access to begin really battling the addiction. So absolutely, it's not just condoning the addiction. It's saying we're going to have a safe place for you to use, but in order to access this, you're also going to access some treatment. It's not forcing you to be in treatment, but I do think that a lot of folks really want to be treated.
Right.
That's what we're finding. And right now, with the fentanyl epidemic, we are seeing more and more people who have been using heroin a long time coming in asking for medical-assisted treatment. One of my colleagues, Skip Sviolka, who was actually our very first guest on our very first show, he works with folks just like this, using Suboxone. So what else, Kathy? I think that's right on the mark, your comment.
Yeah, fentanyl to me is kind of a new, you know, a new drug in terms of my, you know, not that I've taken any of it, but just having, you know, the understanding of people who have been overdosing from heroin for years. Why, you know, what is this fentanyl and where did it come from? Kind of, why is it all of a sudden so prevalent?
That is a great question, Kathy. And my visit to the DEA article today was very educational about the nature of that. And I know that Dr. Joe can speak in much more detail to it, but the history of the epidemic is really remarkable, especially this new wave of opioids that came about in the late 1990s of which fentanyl was one. And fentanyl was a legal created medication for pain, and it found its way into illegal drugs.
Right. And fentanyl has been around for a long time, as Jim is saying. We've been using fentanyl for pain management. It's a very, very effective tool to use for pain management. But it is 100 times stronger than heroin. Just think about that, 100 times stronger. And heroin is pretty strong. All these things really are like morphine. And morphine has been around a long time. There were plays years ago about people addicted to morphine. But I think, Jim, didn't you have a number about the number of prescriptions written?
Yes. Actually, one of the things that is that's focused now, that fentanyl has become something that is in the awareness of the medical industry, is the directives that fentanyl should really be held on to and only written for patients who are in the most excruciating uncontrolled pain.
Right.
Cancer patients, people who really have breakthrough pain. And the assessment is that there's roughly in the United States about 1 million people. So about 1 million prescriptions should be written each year, realistically, to support that population. And last year, there were 6.5 million prescriptions written for fentanyl.
Yeah.
And the question is, how does that happen?
Yeah.
If you've got 1 million people, approximately, that you know really need that painkiller, how did another 5.5 million get legal prescriptions for this? And what's happening to that? Are they addicted to it? Is it because the clinician is doing something illegal? We don't know. And that is, again, some of these things require funds. They require money. They require the government to get behind figuring that out so that we can put a stop to that.
And you know, it's not just, you know, and I hope it's not just physicians who are corrupt. And I hate to say it, but in every business, there are folks like that who are interested in making money at the expense of others. But we now have another really interesting tool, at least here in Massachusetts. If somebody goes in to one doctor to get an opioid medication, they used to potentially go to another doctor maybe an hour later. It was called doctor shopping. We now have a database that we can check and are actually encouraged to check and are going to have to check so that we know which patient has gone to which doctor and whether they have been prescribed an opioid medication. And then if we say, hey, you know, you just got your fentanyl, your Vicodin from somebody else, why are you here? Hopefully we'll be able to put a lid on
some of those. So, Kathy, I just want to leave you with one other small statistic, which is that fentanyl in its raw form, 3 grains of fentanyl that are equivalent to 3 grains of sugar are enough to kill you.
Yep.
And so there's a tremendous concern about this. And we do have another caller that we need to move on to, but I really appreciate your call.
Well, I also wanted to say I think the database is helpful for people who really need the drug.
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely.
So they're not being discriminated against because it's fentanyl.
Absolutely.
Major, major point, Kathy, because pain is real. It's just really hard to measure.
Yes.
Yeah.
We all know that. Pain is invisible. We can measure it a bit, but people must not be deprived of this medication that allows them to live their
lives.
That's
a great observation.
Thanks,
Kathy. I can relate to that, believe me.
Thank you for calling.
So we have Dave from Marshfield who is waiting to speak to us, Dr. Joe.
Hello, Dave from Marshfield.
Hi, Dr. Joe. How are you?
Good. What's your question? How can we help you?
It's really a two-part question. One is that, I mean, if I look back towards, as you were saying before, you know, quite back to the 1800s, the 50s or the 60s, if you take a look at Coltrane or Lou Reed or any of those, there seem to be people who are functioning addicts with heroin, kind of, you know, the natural product versus what we've got today. And I guess the question is, A, do you think there is such a thing as a functioning addict? And, you know, B, if there is, and the problem really is these synthetics that are coming on in adulterated products, would something like the UK's program of registered addict, where they get a clean supply, so to speak, not not like what you're talking about with the shooting galleries, where they could have something that's adulterated, but they're just in a safe place, but where they are actually provided pharmaceuticals, that may be something that would help with this this crisis that we're dealing with.
Yeah, I think both those points are definitely important. And let's talk a little bit about them.
And that's some more of what we appreciate, which is out-of-the-box thinking, because right. this problem doesn't seem to be getting any better. It seems to be just simply getting worse.
Right. So first, functioning addict. I mean, we know that there are people who live their lives, and you would never know that they were addicted to heroin, addicted to alcohol, addicted to all sorts of substances. They are what we call functioning. The real question is, can they function if they don't have the drug? And the answer then is probably no. They would have to go through significant withdrawal, medically be monitored, and then they actually may be able to function at another level, maybe different, certainly a different IM, as we would say. So it's such almost an oxymoron. What is the quality of life of somebody who is functioning, but every 2 hours has to go someplace, get a shot of heroin, or whatever it is, so that they don't go into withdrawal? And that really is the price that you pay. I mean, if these things last a couple of hours, and then they begin to wear off, and you get the withdrawal. That's what keeps the person addicted. And the folks who are in this category of functioning, they're not really getting high anymore. They're using the drug to sustain their life so that they are not sick from withdrawal. Now, the other aspect about registered addicts, I think that's a great idea. I really do, as long as it doesn't stigmatize. And that, I think, has been the fear in the United States and other countries, is how do you get somebody to come forward and say, this is my medical condition, if they fear that they are then going to be shunned and stigmatized and seen as some modern-day pariah, a leper who really doesn't belong in our society. That, I think, we're getting closer to. I think as we become more aware of what addiction is and that it's a medical condition and that people who have addiction need help, that may very well lead us to see people come out of the shadows. Dave,
yep.
Thanks. If you want to stick around, you can, but we have to take a quick commercial break.
Thanks, Joe.
We are just 3 years away from the 400th anniversary of the founding of Plymouth Colony, and Plymouth 400 is gearing up for events and programs that will educate, engage, and excite. Be part of this once-in-a-lifetime event by ordering a 2020 commemorative license plate, and you, too, can drive America's story. Order your 2020 license plate today at plymouth400inc.org/license plate. Looking for another way to get involved? Plymouth 400 is looking for volunteers to donate their time and talents to help make this commemoration one that leaves lasting legacies for generations to come. You can help make this anniversary an impactful moment for our community, our country, and our world. Visit plymouth400inc.org for more information. Plymouth 400, an American story, a national legacy.
There's no better time to start pursuing the degree you've always dreamed of. At Eastern Nazarene College Adult and Graduate Studies, our programs give busy adults the opportunity to earn a degree without uprooting work, family, and life. We offer associate, bachelor's, and master's degrees in business, education, and marriage and family therapy. Submit your application today for fall 2017. Call 617-745-3000 to connect with an enrollment counselor or visit adultstudies.enc.edu to learn more.
Miramar Retreat Center of Duxbury's 14th Annual Some Enchanted Evening will be held on Saturday, August 5th. The social hour begins at 5:30, followed by an elegant sit-down dinner prepared on site by Miramar's talented gourmet chef. Bid on the silent auction items and then relax and enjoy a delightful musical performance by Tony Funches, former lead singer of The Platters. All this is still only $100. Proceeds benefit the work of the Miramar Retreat Center in serving people of all denominations and ages who seek spiritual guidance. For more information about purchasing tickets, call Miramar Retreat Center at 781-585-2460. See you on August 5th.
Hi, folks. This is Jim Quine, and we are on the Dr. Joe Show here, and we have been talking this evening about the problems of the opioid epidemic and discussing in particular the impact of fentanyl on that. And we've heard a lot from some great callers who have offered up some stories, some really courageous stories of their own situation and challenges with addiction, as well as some really great input on different ideas in terms of how we can find a solution to this. And we are at 781-837-4900. We only have about 6 minutes left, but we would love to hear from you. You know, what do you think? Do you think that the United States government, that state governments should pay for not just a place for people to get their drugs to deal with their addiction, but also to pay for the drugs themselves? Is that where we should be spending our money? Where else?
We are spending money on Narcan, right? I mean, more and more first responders have Narcan. They're not paying for it, right? The state is paying for Narcan.
Absolutely, and let's face it, we know that the outcomes in terms of the number of deaths would be significantly worse without that amazing medication.
That's right. And insurance companies are now willing to pay for medical assisted treatment. So they will pay for somebody to be in a methadone clinic or in a Suboxone clinic or in a Naltrexone and Vivitrol clinic. And, you know, these
which is great if you have insurance.
That's the problem.
And therein lies a major issue, right, especially with potential changes to what might be happening
right,
as far as healthcare is concerned.
But you know, again, you know, High Point Treatment Center, you know, under the watch of Daniel Mumbauer, who's the CEO, it's a charity. So we have a commitment. If you don't have insurance, if you can't pay, we'll treat you anyway.
Which, and all of those things, I think, have the potential to help. But we continue to see the numbers rise. And so we, I believe, have to have a dialogue about what as a people, what as a society, what paths are we going to take? And I don't believe that there's one solution. The kinds of programs that you are really actively working on have tremendous potential. But, you know, I'll point out that being aware of Drug Story Theater and that program that you've put together, I mean, you know, realistically, you have, you know, you and, you know, people that are close to you.
The ones that Kathleen Wright,
exactly,
Carol and Aaron and Nicole and all the kids who are part of this.
And the kids who are part of it. You know, you're putting that together on a shoestring, and I know that you are getting some support from the state and some private contributions, but there's an educational opportunity. You know, that kind of program should be in every school in the Commonwealth.
It should be.
And beyond that, the questions of where that money is being spent, you know, it is so frustrating that none of the money from legalized marijuana, which is, look, I'm not making any kind of a judgment about whether marijuana is good or marijuana is bad, but the voters in Massachusetts voted for it. And so that is the law. That's because we're in a democracy, thank God, whether we agree with the decision or not. But ultimately, we know that there is the potential to lead to a gateway, a pathway.
Absolutely.
To more serious drug addiction.
Yes, it is.
And I guess the question that I have is, why a 20% tax to pay for the organization that's going to manage that, and nothing for addiction, nothing for treatment, nothing for education, even more importantly, because something has to be done at the roots of this problem that's going to change the path. The pathway now is for it to continue to get worse. And the kinds of opportunities that there are to put a stop to it, to begin to change it, that's not being funded. The minimal amount of money that a program like Drug Story Theater gets is far outweighed by the kinds of costs that are involved with distributing Narcan and training first responders to be able to save people. And that is just part of what we're looking at. And we as a society have got to be able to look at some practical ways of funding the kinds of programs that will actually start to slow and change the direction of this problem.
But there then has to be a commitment and an awareness. And I think that is what is growing, is it is growing that there you know, we're calling it a national crisis. You know, Governor Christie and then others, you know, they formed this group.
Yes.
Hopefully, there will be the funds. But in order for there to be the funds, people have to acknowledge that it's the problem. The other part that I want to say is, if we're going to have people at the table, it can't just be the policymakers. We have to listen. We have to listen to the families. We have to listen to the people in recovery. But we have to listen to the people who are actively using as well. They have knowledge for us. They need to be at the table to help us formulate a really cogent way, not just of treatment, but of prevention. And that's part of what we're doing with Drugs Free Theater.
Absolutely.
Those kids in recovery are absolutely helping other kids. The treatment of one becomes the prevention of many. If people are interested, we have a website, drugsfreetheater.org. Please go check it out.
And remember, folks, we talk about IM, and that's really the core focus of our show. But keep in mind that we cannot change anyone, but we can influence
them. That's right.
And society has an IM as well, and we can influence that too.
You control no one. You influence everyone. And small changes have big effects.
Good night, everybody. We'll look forward to seeing you next Thursday.
Good night, folks. At least hear from you.
Wild, who knows? Van Gogh. Stretch the canvas, brush with madness. Is it sadness or just a show that